Okay. Come in, folks. I'd like for us to start with one thing that needs to be finished up from our class last week. We ran out of time last time, and one of the questions or one of the comments that we had raised about the idea of efforts to restore as close to get as close as possible to the original Greek text, say, of the New Testament. And some of the questions that are raised by that seem to create a lack of confidence or seem to make us think that things get left out of the Bible. And I'd like you to remember the three protective statements that God makes in Deuteronomy and in Proverbs 30 and then in Revelation 22 to the effect that things, what does it say, that neither to do this or this? All right. It says that we're neither to take away, those are not for today, I'm not looking at them today, neither to add to nor to take away. Now, I'd like you to notice with this that it says no adding or no taking away. Now, what gets my attention when I watch our responses to studies about the text of the Scripture is that we focus on this one. My question to you and what we've been trying to talk about is that if in the process of copying and recopying, as had to be done before there was a printing press and so forth, the text of the Scriptures, and if you have scribes who are paid to do this or who do this with their time and so forth, and you go along like this and you're copying words and phrases, and you get a word which some scribe thinks needs to be explained or completed, or if you have places where something is said in one of the Gospels, for example, the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which is lost, for example. And a scribe gets so used to copying that gospel and so forth, that if it comes to another gospel and in the same context, that particular phrase might not have been in Luke, we'll say, or might not have been in Matthew where it was in Luke. And it's so familiar to him that he puts it in. All right, and let's say that that here, or if in one place it says Jesus Christ, the Son of God, in another place it says the Son of God, or it says Jesus, and the scribe, not intending to do evil or to corrupt the text of the New Testament, writes, say where it says Jesus, he adds to it Christ. That's, and by the way, that's the slight nature of the so-called variations in the New Testament text. Now, we'll just say here that here's where it says Jesus. And the scribe comes along and he attaches Christ to it. Now, is it taking away from the Bible if in studying and comparing the manuscript evidence that we have available, the conclusion is reached that it gets closer to what the original said for it to say this one? I've taken the most extreme case here because I'm dealing with what people feel like is the divine nature of Jesus, which everybody in this class knows I'm deeply convinced about, and that thought rules my life. But is that taking away, or was it adding to when the mistake was made originally? Now that's all we're saying, and it's all that that we're trying to communicate here. That when you're looking for what the original text said, you have to look at things like that. What was it originally? All right, now I want to go today, moving toward the English translation of the Scripture, the English, the availability of the Bible in English. And there are a few dates which, with my present state of mind, I needed to bring the dates with me today. So I hope you'll bear with me about this. But let's allow the arrival of the printing press in 1456 A.D. to be a sort of a milestone here, because that begins to make available in more of a mass form the production of the Bible in ways that can be spread more to common people and not just in the hands of the experts, who then could tell everybody else or explain to everybody else what they said. This is the year Gutenberg printed what's now the famous Gutenberg Bible, the Bible in Latin, and it also began to make available the printed Greek text of the New Testament. And I'll just mention a couple of these that we've mentioned before. First of all, Erasmus, the first man to put the text of the Greek text of the New Testament to print. And he did so in 1516 A.D., his first edition of this. And it begins to be printed and made available then to, say, universities or schools or anyone who could afford it, we'll say. And the interesting thing about Erasmus' work was that it started to set the tone for what would be regarded as the popular Greek text or the accepted Greek text. And what Erasmus did is, wherever he did not have a Greek manuscript of the New Testament that he would be able to translate, he took the Latin Vulgate of Jerome and translated that into Greek himself. Now, can you see any way there where a ground for some of these variants that people complain about could have been laid right there? You can't you? That's easy to see. And if you're taking Greek to translate it into English, but you or to print it, but you don't have Greek, so you translate Latin into Greek, you might get some variation from what the Greek originally said. It might mean the same thing. And usually that's how this works. It's not a question of what the Bible means in these cases, but it's the question of the text, okay?
Some of the languages didn't have vowels, and they were all just capital letters all jammed together, right? So it made it hard.
Whenever you find the Greek always had vowels, the Hebrew didn't, as Brother Feeney said. The Hebrew was written straight together and so forth. Whenever you mention uncials in Greek, you're talking about capital letters with no space between them. And that's right here. But just for our purposes now, Erasmus publishes the first Greek New Testament, first edition in 1516. It was followed by a production by a man named Ximenes, which his work is often with the Gospels and the four Gospels, that will be called the Complutensian Polyglot. And it has, as part of it, both Greek, it has Greek and Latin together. So it gives both ideas with that. Another one comes out in about the year 1546 by a man, he goes, but he's known by two names. We'll call him Stephanus. Can anybody guess why? It's easier to say. All right. And about 1546, Stephanus' Greek Testament comes out, and He provided in it notations. The important thing about this is that his one of his editions of this is the first case in which verse markings were added. In 1551, Stephanus' work with verse markings was printed, and one of the things I found, Neil Pryor recounts the story about somebody kiddingly said that Stephanus was riding on his horse and reading his Bible, and every time the horse jostled him, that's when he made a verse. In other words, to show the kind of random way in which these were sometimes done. It's important to remember that the chapters and verses are not inspired, the markings of them, but instead were added by this man. And then another Greek text by Theodore Beza is published in, I don't have the year jotted down here, but it became also an important work. And the reason I'm writing these down is that I want you to see that these came to be related to each other, and one tends to be a revision of the other. So you kind of see that the process is going on here. And what happens is that two brothers, Bonaventure and Abraham Elzevar, who issue a Greek text in 1629, and you'll see in a moment why this is important. I'll just write the brother's name like this. In 1629, come out with a printed version or a printed Greek text of the New Testament. In their third edition, they advertised in the preface of their edition with this sentence, and this is translated, "Therefore you have the text now received by all, in which we give nothing changed or corrupted." That little phrase, "text received by all," comes to be in Latin, "textus receptus." And you'd be surprised how many arguments about the Bible or about translation of the Bible revolve around that little phrase from the 1633 edition of these men's printed Greek text. And there are a lot of people who think that the Textus Receptus was written by the apostles in their own hand and handed down directly and straightly to modern generations, and that we received it directly from divine work. And you'd be, it's interesting how many debates go on just pretty much from that background. Now, I'm going to leave this up here. I'd like you to kind of contemplate what I've just said here. And this one, in 1633, and it gets written like this, "Textus Receptus," the received text. Okay. Now, what about in English, and especially with regard to the printing press? Actually, the English translations of the Bible started 100 years before the printing press. And remember, we talked a little bit about this before. John Wycliffe comes out with an English translation of the Bible, although most of us would not recognize it like this. How many of you had to read Chaucer in school? Barney did, he just doesn't remember. We were in class together. We had to read Chaucer in school, or Shakespeare, or you've seen something. It starts out with Anglo-Saxon, and then it comes to be what usually gets referred to as Middle English, and then it turns into more modern English. And so some of these English translations, it'd be really tough for us to read. But they're of extremely important steps in the process, and they have phrases in them that you and I still quote verbatim. And I'll show you, try to show you some of these as we go along. Wycliffe was a contemporary of Geoffrey Chaucer, and used the same language. He desired strongly for there to be an English Bible for the common man, and he, an Oxford-educated fellow, proceeded with this, turned out to be open war with Rome over it, too. I mean, it was... Now, I want you to see here that any time the Bible has been put in the language of the common man, there's been a fuss over it. And you can kind of can count on that. Wycliffe, and here's a quote of something that he has said, "No man is so rude a scholar but that he can learn the words of the gospel according to his simplicity." Now, in general, do we agree with that statement or not? I think in general we do. The gospel has a simplicity and appeal to it that anybody can and should understand for himself. So he produces in about 1382 beginning. And I'm going to use that date here. I gave you a more complete dating of this on another outline. But proceeded to translate the Bible into English. Now here's the important thing. He did it from the Latin Vulgate. You remember who was the translator of the Latin Vulgate and about when? Jerome, somewhere around 400 A.D., all right? So Wycliffe did not know Greek. And he's translating the Bible into English, not from Greek, but from Latin. And he also did very little of the translation himself. He has two associates who do most of that for him, and they did a really an earth-shattering work in a whole lot of ways, and you have to admire them for their courage and for their work. A synod met in 1382 and condemned what Wycliffe was doing. A synod met in 1408 and forbade the circulation of his Bible. In other words, it was not necessarily a welcome effort. Wycliffe died of a stroke soon afterward, and his associates went ahead and produced actually two translations, one very literal and another one idiomatic English, more the way people talk. So one flat wooden and the other one a little more free. One with here's exactly how the words are and here's what it says, you know, that kind of thing. It was very expensive. Fox, F-O-X-E, wrote at the time, in old English, and I can't read it, so I'm going to translate it to you. I didn't know I was a translator. Some gave a load of... I can read this because I'm from Arkansas. Some gave is G-A-U-E, a load is L-O-D-E, of hay for a few chapters of St. James or St. Paul in English. That's how precious it was for them. The Roman Catholic Church, and by the way, all of this happens in the context of religious and political intrigue. You've got to know that. The Protestant versus Catholic, the various kings and their power plays that were involved in this, they tried to prevent people from reading from Wycliffe's work. And I'll give you a couple of ideas. In 1414, a law was enacted that anybody reading Wycliffe's writings should forfeit land, cattle, life, and goods from their heirs forever. Now why? Well, because the hierarchy wanted to make sure that they held the power to tell people what they were supposed to believe. Still, though, his Bible was published and spread, and some of the expressions that you and I, I'm going to read you a few expressions out of Wycliffe's Bible from 1382. See if you recognize. How about these? Straight gate. All right. Make whole. If you will, you can make me whole. Or compass land and sea. What Jesus said to the Pharisees about the hypocrisy. Son of perdition. Or how about this one? Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. How many times have we expressed our hope in that way? Or this one, the mote and the beam from Matthew chapter 7. All of those were from Wycliffe. Wycliffe said that everybody ought to have the opportunity to hear the Bible or to read the Bible in his tongue. And that gives you an idea of this man's work. More important, and with them, with the church and the government making it illegal for work like Wycliffe's to be done, it shouldn't be a surprise that we go 100 years before another step is taken in this process, and this time it's with Tyndale, William Tyndale. Most of us who ever read anything in the English Bible owe everything to William Tyndale. In a lot of ways, since the Pope decreed that the Bible was not to be put into English, and since it was outlawed, it was a risk for a man to embark on a project like this. William Tyndale argued he's a message is brought to him by a clerical authority that he's not to do this translating work. And Tyndale's response was, quote, "If God spare my life, ere many years I'll cause a boy that driveth a plow shall know more of the scriptures than thou doest." That wasn't an answer you wanted to make if you wanted to keep your head attached to your body. He overcame the challenges to get this done. You ought to read about William Tyndale. Tyndale said, "The Greek tongue agreeth more with the English than with the Latin." In other words, it would be clearer to put what the Greek meant into English than it was possible to do with the Latin. And he said that the properties of the Hebrew tongue from the Old Testament agreeth 1,000 times more with English than with Latin. And he says the manner of speaking is both one, the idiomatic ways in which we speak. And so he insisted that this had to be done. Now, what else is going on about this time? Well, the Renaissance comes along. The people begin to emerge from the Dark Ages. The English language is developing rapidly, becoming a beautiful language and a much more precise language. The printing press adds to all of this. So Tyndale goes to Oxford, and he studies at the feet of, guess who? All right. Now, what do you think would happen as far as the text that might underlie the translation that Tyndale produces? You expect that he'll go down here and use this one? No. You can kind of see what I'm getting at. He comes out with his first edition of the New Testament in 1525, and that's the phrase I'm going to use. Look how close that is in time to Tyndale's publishing of the New Testament in print. So Tyndale's first English version comes out, and he had enough understanding of the Greek text and also enough dedication to the value of the text to be able to do this and to have the courage to risk his life to do this and to have the belief that it would bless people and that it needed to be done. He's a unique individual in a lot of ways. He had to leave England in order to do this, did a lot of the work in other places. In Germany, he translated the New Testament from the original Greek, and copies of it were smuggled into England in bales of cloth.
And flour.
And flour, that's right. His last edition of the New Testament appeared in 1535, and 40 editions of it had been printed by 1566. All right, here are some expressions from Tyndale's work. See if you recognize any of these. You cannot serve God and mammon. That's from William Tyndale. Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. That phrase has served us well, hasn't it, since 1525. A prophet is not without honor, save in his own country. That's how he said it. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them. It's more blessed to give than to receive. The phrase, the unsearchable riches of Christ, is from William Tyndale. Forgive us our trespasses, even as we forgive as we forgive those who trespassed against us. I didn't say that exactly right, but you see the idea. If those phrases that appeared with this man up here that I mentioned a minute ago, and then these here are familiar to us still, what does that tell you about the process of English translation? Pardon?
It doesn't seem to change.
All right. If it changes, it changes in the form of revision. It uses phrases which have become a way for us to understand what the Greek text says or what the original text says. And it's not a matter where a new version necessarily throws out everything that went before it. Unless a man putting it out has an agenda all his own that, or an axe that he wants to grind. Tyndale was at last betrayed by a friend, and he was imprisoned and executed. That is, he was strangled and burned at the stake near Brussels in 1536 as a thanks for his work of putting the Bible into English. Was it controversial to spread around the Bible for a thing?
We have to remember who the enemy was of the translation into English. It was the Roman Catholic.
And even later, Church of England in some ways too. You're exactly right. Both the Roman Catholic Church certainly persecuted this man, and then both persecuted this man. And in fact, to show you, Tyndale's last words were, "Lord, open thou the King of England's eyes." And here's the rest of the story. Copies of his work were bought and burned. Sir Thomas More criticized Tyndale, especially for using words like congregation, love, and repent, instead of church, charity, and do penance. It's estimated that as many as 50,000 copies of his New Testament were still circulated before he died. And you may remember that they finally even dug up his body, burned his bones into ashes, and threw them in the river. That shows you maybe the degree of resentment that this caused. All right, I just try to tell you a little more quickly about a few of the other steps in this process, and I hope that by the time we finish, you'll see why this is helpful. In 1535, Miles Coverdale, who was an associate of Tyndale, 1535, issued a Bible based on Tyndale's work and the work of others. It was the first complete printed English Bible to be printed. In other words, not just the New Testament, but also the Old, 1535. This Bible also had a great deal of influence. In fact, this one here is 1 year after Henry VIII repudiated the authority of the Pope. You can see that it's a tense time. But this Bible was dedicated to Henry VIII, and it was a translation from existing works, not from Hebrew and Greek. And that's an important point. It was translated from Latin or from other works and not from Hebrew and Greek. Here are several phrases from Coverdale's Bible. I think these are interesting. I hope you'll think about it. Man goeth to his long home, from Ecclesiastes 12. Remember that one? Or the pride of life, from 1 John 2:16. That's Coverdale's phrase. The world passes away, 1 John 2:17. The term loving kindness, for the Hebrew word kesed, or steadfast love, or mercy, or tender mercy. King, loving kindness is his phrase. I will lift up mine eyes into the hills. Psalm 121. What a beautiful phrase. Or this one. I heard this saying at camp several times this past week. Cast me not away from thy presence, O Lord, and take not thy Holy Spirit from me. Psalm 51, isn't that beautiful? Is there no balm in Gilead? Or the phrase swaddling clothes. I never knew exactly what swaddling clothes were, but Coverdale apparently did, and we still use the phrase. The king this time did not authorize Coverdale's work, but at least permitted it. And the religious atmosphere started to change in England, and because it was now legal, many more Bibles began to be printed. There's what's called the Matthew's Bible, 1537. Write it like this here. Matthew's Bible, 1537. Notice this is just 2 years later on now after this one. This gets confusing, but Thomas Matthews was a pen name for a guy whose real name was John Rogers. Are you confused enough? He also died at the stake. This Bible was an edited version of the previous two. That's all it was. It was an edited version of the previous two, and it was the first, can I quote it this way, authorized version in England, or in English. And the preface read in part, set forth with the kings was K-I-N-G-E-S, most gracious, and gracious was G-R-A-C-Y-O-U-S, license, L-Y-C-E-N-C-E. And you think about this idea of authorizer, the people who think that came from God. No, it's the king's idea. Richard Taverner. Doesn't mean that he went to a tavern either. Richard Taverner, that phrase, published a Bible, the first one to be completely printed in English. And this is in 1539. It was done fairly hurriedly. This man was a lawyer, but he also was an excellent Greek scholar, and he did the work himself, Taverner. It came out about the same time as this next one. It didn't get a lot of attention. The next one, most important, was the Great Bible, so-called. The Great Bible comes out in 1540. Okay. You see, we're making the journey now for almost 200 years, of what happens here. This work was overseen by Coverdale. See? So I'm trying to illustrate in doing this that these are not each one replacing the other, but there is a continual process of refinement and correction and improvements, or at least effort to improve. This is the first officially authorized Bible of the Church of England. A great Bible. It sold for about 3 weeks' wages of a skilled laborer, and it bore the imprint appointed to be read in the churches. Appointed by whom and what? By the king in the churches of England. And each parish was ordered to buy a copy and set it up in the church for the use of all. And 17 editions later up have been done by this. The Geneva Bible is the next one in this order. Geneva Bible played an important role in the Reformation. It's the first time an English New Testament was numbered into verses like Stephanus had done. Saint Bell get us, Saint Bell got us. You guys have to tell me because I sure can't hear it right now. These men, if you think about this, these men invested their lives. They invested their lives in the study of Hebrew and Greek and other languages, and sometimes risked their lives to try to make what those manuscripts said available to common and ordinary people. And it always was a process that caused no small amount of trouble. That's the main thing I want you to see. And I'm leading up here to the King James appearance in 1611. Next week I'll bring a reproduction of that to try to show you, let you see what goes on. But I want you to see that the King James appeared in 1611. When did the Textus Receptus first, was it called that? People think that the King James Version was done based on the Textus Receptus, and that any change or revision of it is rejection of that text. Not true. It's not true. And you can see what we're getting at with that. You guys have been patient with me today. I appreciate it very much. And we'll move next week now with King James, more with English that we understand and still use. Thank you guys for being with us.